Dr. Andrew Lee, the federal member for Fraser, who is our guest speaker today. Professor Ingrid Moses, the former Chancellor of the University and formerly the Vice-Chancellor of the University of New England, and John Moses. I have seen Professor Don Aitken here, the former Vice-Chancellor of this university, Dennis Truin, a member of the University Council. I'd like to welcome all alumni of the university. I think we have some colleagues from the ANU. Welcome to you and to all visitors here at the campus. I'd like to acknowledge, as we try always to do on important occasions, that the land we're meeting on is land of which the Ngunnawal people are the traditional custodians, and I extend my respect to their elders, past and present. This new series, the Challenge Your Mind Public Lectures, has been created to encourage speakers and the audience to share their ideas on a range of topics, global, national, and local. And it's fair to say that we would like these ideas to be challenging ones rather than comforting or comfortable ones. I suppose we could have a parallel series, Numb Your Mind, but we already have television. So we would like these lectures to be at the forefront of thinking so that members of the public can contribute and help shape the way that Australian thought is moving. This series goes alongside a number of specific lecture series that we now have. You may know that we have the National Security Lecture Series every month, where an ambassador, a high commissioner, or a senior government official presents on a national security topic. We have the ANZOG Institute of Governance Canberra Conversation, convened by John Stanhope. We have the CERAF Lectures, the Centre for Research and Action on Public Health, on a health topic. We have CREST's Lectures, the Centre for Research in Therapeutic Solutions on medical discoveries. We have NATSEM seminars and workshops, and we're obviously here in the building which is the home of NATSEM, sharing independent research contributing to social and economic policy debates. We have the annual Ngunnawal Lecture, an initiative of our Ngunnawal Centre, which is aimed to give voice to the Indigenous Australian position on important topics. And finally, we have the annual Don Aitken Lecture, which was established in 2005. And I can say that the speaker this year will be Robin Archer in that lecture series. And now we have Challenge Your Mind, which is meant to be a generic and high-profile series to help us engage. And I hope you can see that the university is trying to engage with its various communities in an organised and a systematic way, engaging intellectually with our communities and bringing out the many voices that a civilised society should hear and should think about. So it's with great pleasure that I'm able today to introduce Dr. Andrew Lee as our guest speaker. Dr. Lee is a valued supporter of UC, having delivered a guest lecture already this year on civil society, politics and policy. And also, late last year, you helped launch UC's Mobile Health Clinic, which offers allied health services along the New South Wales coast. And we were able to spar by swapping numerous puns on health-related terminology. Dr. Lee was elected as the federal member for Fraser in 2010. Before that, he was Professor of Economics at the ANU. He has written extensively on a range of subjects, including education, taxation and social policy, and he also writes regularly for the Australian press. He holds a PhD in public policy from Harvard University, having graduated from the University of Sydney with first-class honours in law and arts. He's previously worked as a lawyer, and this included a period as associate to Michael Kirby, the High Court judge, and he's also worked as a principal advisor to the Australian Treasury. Dr. Lee is a fellow of the Australian Academy of Social Sciences and in 2011 received the Young Economist Award, a prize given every 2 years by the Economic Society of Australia to the best Australian economist under 40. Every 2 years, economical prize. For those keen Twitter fans in the audience today, and I know there are numerous, if you'd like to keep up to date using with the conversation, you can use hashtag NakedTruth. And so it is now my pleasure to launch the Challenge Your Mind lecture series by welcoming Dr. Andrew Lee to talk about The Naked Truth, Media and Politics in the Digital Age. Andrew.
Thank you very much, Stephen, for a very warm and generous introduction. Can I, of course, begin by acknowledging we're meeting on the traditional lands of the Ngunnawal people and pay my respects to their elders, past and present, and also to acknowledge Chancellors and Vice-Chancellors, past and present, who are with us today. It did occur to me, Stephen, that as you were going through the introduction, I should savour the under 40 tag, given that I have 2 days left in which to do that. UC is, of course, one of Australia's premier journalism schools, and so the topic I chose today was deliberate in the sense that I think there is perhaps no better place in Australia to speak about this complicated interplay between the media and politics, which is so defining us. But let me begin with a story. At the end of 1992, a team of us got together at Sydney University to run for the student newspaper, Ani Soir. We needed a name with a hint of journalistic credibility and a bucket load of electoral appeal. So we opted to call ourselves The Naked Truth. We threw ourselves into the campaign with the kind of frisky eagerness only a dozen 20-year-olds can manage. By day, we sang our campaign song to bemused classes, removing much of our clothing to reinforce the team name. By night, we put up posters and chalked The Naked Truth around the campus, wishing as we did so we'd chosen a shorter name. One of our team, Verity Firth, even brought along her younger brother, Charles Firth, to help out. I like to think that that's Charles's first taste of fame. A class of medical students promised to vote for us en bloc if a member of the Naked Truth team would streak naked through their lecture hall. One of us obliged. And so my year as a journalist began. I interviewed Andrew Denton, Henry Zepps, and Dorothy McRae McMahon. Went inside Long Bay Jail and inside a submarine, spoke to a magician, a monk, and a basketball commentator, and wrote about child sponsorship, biblical literalism, and virtual reality machines. In a display of youthful chutzpah, I also reviewed a handful of sports cars, making me, I hope, the only motoring writer in the history of student journalism. When the 1993 election came around, I managed to get Keating and Hewson to answer 20 questions apiece. And the year even got me my first article in the Sydney Morning Herald on illegal street racing. I loved journalism, but even at the level of student journalism, I found it hard. Pitching stories, separating beef from bulldust, staying objective. Since writing for Ani, I've written hundreds of thousands of words in newspapers, but all of them have been opinion. And because of that, I approached the topic of journalism with a modicum of trepidation. Plus, because I'm a politician, you should probably regard my views on journalists as being akin to the views that a kangaroo has about gun ownership. The first thing to say is that journalism really can change the world. Emile Zola's letter, J'accuse, did more than win the freedom of Alfred Dreyfus. It changed the political character of modern France. In their reporting of Watergate, Woodward and Bernstein brought down a president. In Australia, reporting by the Courier Mail and the Four Corners program ended the Bjelke-Petersen government and led to the jailing of three ministers. In 2005, a newspaper article brought down New South Wales opposition leader John Brogdon and probably changed the outcome of the 2007 New South Wales election. Journalists make wonderful company. Not many people are great listeners and splendid raconteurs, but my journalist friends all meet that description. As a reader, I delight in the wit of Annabel Crabb, the global view of Peter Harcher, the economic nous of Peter Martin, the eccentric curiosity of the late Peter Vaness. I really like those Peters, don't I? The forensic reporting of Neil Chenoweth. Watching Emma Alberici grill Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov about his nation's disgraceful position on Syria made me enormously proud of our public broadcaster. I could add dozens of other examples, but I'll just sum up with this. I would happily put Australia's best journalists up against any in the world. So for the most part today, my argument won't be about individuals. Sure, I wish there were more great journalists and fewer crummy ones. And I'm sure they'd say the same about my profession. But frankly, there's not much point in politicians and journalists engaging in a name-calling exercise. Right now, the share of the Australian population that rates either profession, politicians or journalists, as highly ethical or honest, has fallen to 1 in 10. So we need to start thinking systematically. As an economist, that's my natural inclination. Human agency can be important, but pivotal changes are generally the result of technology and policy, not individual actions. People respond to incentives, so if you want better behaviour, improving the incentives generally works better than moral exhortation. And the big technological shift in media has been the falling cost of disseminating ideas. Cable and digital television have expanded the number of channels. Digital radio will have the same effect on that medium. Ubiquitous broadband has allowed news to be conveyed through a host of electronic media. Among Australian adults who are online, almost all use social media. 76% use Facebook, 10% use Twitter. And about half of all Australian politicians tweet. After undertaking a month-long randomised trial at the start of this year, I joined them. The effect of all of these changes has been increased competition in the media market. By international standards, the Australian media, particularly our newspapers, are not especially competitive. So competition from news outlets has come as a particular shock to incumbent players in the Australian media market. One of the main places you see the impact of competition is the contest between outlets to be first with the story. Under the old model, papers told you the latest news as of 12 hours earlier, and the evening news told you all of the things that had happened during the day. But competition from online news outlets and 24-hour news channels has made that increasingly unsustainable. Increasingly, people are choosing faster-paced media. Asked their most important source of news information, 31% nominated commercial TV, 30% said the internet, 13% said a daily newspaper. As Tony Blair's pointed out, his 1997 election campaign took an issue a day. By 2005, his election campaign had to have one for the morning, one for the afternoon, and by the evening, the agenda had already moved on. In the 1980s, Treasurer Keating would go on the road to sell the budget for a full month. In the 1990s, Treasurer Costello would take a fortnight for his budget tour. By the time Costello had left office, the budget roadshow had shrunk to less than a week. This wasn't anyone's fault. It's simply a function of the national attention span. My central thesis in this speech is that the technological changes in media have led to greater inequality in political information than ever before. For engaged citizens, there's never been a better time to be a news consumer. You can watch your press conferences live on Sky and get transcripts of radio programs in different cities. You can access the opinions of thoughtful bloggers and sassy tweeters. Engaged citizens are now better informed about political news than they've ever been before. And then there's the remainder of the population. Some who are too busy with family and community to bother with national politics. Others who are more interested in Larrabingal than Laurie Oaks. And those who don't seek out political information, but let it come to them. For this group of disengaged citizens, there's a growing disconnect from the political process. For example, at the last election, 6.8% failed to cast a ballot and 5.5% voted informal. That's over 12% of the Australian electorate who didn't participate in the democratic process. I believe that the changes in the media are one of the factors making this group of Australians more disconnected from politics. In effect, technology's widened the information gap between the most informed and the least informed members of society. The notion that technology can have different impacts across society is a familiar one to economists. We use the term skill-biased technological change to capture the idea that some technological innovations both help high-skilled workers and hurt lower-skilled workers. To take an example, while computerisation was making lawyers more efficient, it was making typists redundant. And the thing about skill-biased technological change is that if you're among the group that benefits, you can easily miss the negative side. My guess is that many of you in this room will be engaged news consumers who most keenly feel the upside, the wealth of new information now available at your fingertips. But it's important to take account of the impact across society if we're to get a full picture of how the media has changed people's views of politics. From the perspective of the most engaged citizens, the media is more abundant, diverse, and accessible now than in the past. Yet that's not how things look to many Australians. Taken as a whole, the media has become more opinionated, nastier, and shallower. The shift hasn't taken place because individual journalists have grown horns and forked tongues, but because the technological changes have privileged these kinds of voices. Opinion, nastiness, and shallowness have always been there, but they've flourished over recent decades. Let's start with opinion. Most of the new political news websites that have emerged over recent decades are dominated by comment. Those include The Drum, The Punch, The Conversation, Crikey, Inside Story, The National Times, Australian Policy Online, Online Opinion. In fact, the only political news website that hasn't increased the overall opinion to news ratio is the Global Mail, which, in general, doesn't print opinion pieces. On television, stations such as Sky and ABC 24 thrive on commentary. In some cases, guests on these shows are print journalists who will sometimes do multiple interviews a day and then file for the web and print editions of their newspapers. Former Kevin Rudd Press Secretary Lachlan Harris has argued every year the number of journalists goes down and the number of commentators goes up. In 1990, the Parliamentary Press Gallery had 252 journalists working in television, print, and radio. In 2010, that had decreased to 179. One factor is simple economics. Journalism costs money, comment is often free. And as comment proliferates, there's the temptation to blur the boundaries between news and opinion. To take the small but significant step from arguing that a policy could be implemented to arguing that it should be. To make oneself a player, not merely an impartial watcher from the sidelines. In a world where economic policy gets steadily more and more complex, where Australia's future is close-knit to the Asian region, I worry when I see journalistic resources diverted from making sense of policies and events to simple commentating on the events of the front page. We seem to have devalued good reporting. Recently, Yale University journalism students were asked how they would have gone about investigating Watergate. To the shock of their guest speaker, Bob Woodward, most students essentially said they would Google Nixon's secret fund. In Australia, I must have read 100 comment pieces about the politics of asylum seekers, but I don't recall one single journalist having asked the Malaysian government, why didn't you sign the Refugee Convention? Rather than endless speculation on the relationship between opinion polls and interest rates, would it be worth exploring what an interest rate cut is likely to do to the price of an imported TV? Again, this comes down to information inequality. The engaged news consumer sees opinion as really adding to their smorgasbord. Disengaged news consumers are increasingly finding themselves getting fewer facts and more commentary. Perhaps my view on opinion is somewhat shaped by an email that a senior opinion writer sent me a couple of years ago. Allow me to quote a few lines. I'm prepared to spend my last dollar and effort of energy to avoid having you purporting to represent my views in Parliament. And that is apart from the fact that you are a crap statistician. You are a f***ing disgrace, the more so because your electorate has a higher standard than you. And I will not lose a moment saying so, in any audience, in any place, and to everyone who asks my opinion. In case you're wondering, I emailed the journalist to say that since the two of us had never spoken, perhaps we should have lunch together. My concern about comment is not mostly about ideological bias. Sure, the Labor Party is not exactly having a dream run in the mainstream press at the moment, but I know enough history to recognise that the worm turns. Curtin won his 1943 landslide election with Packer and Murdoch against him. In the late 1980s, Hawke was backed by most of the mainstream media. In 2003, Howard government minister Richard Alston made 68 official complaints against the ABC for allegedly being biased against the then Howard government in reporting the Iraq War. My own systematic study of media bias, co-authored with University of Toronto Professor Joshua Gans, found that from the period 1996 to 2004, most Australian media outlets occupied centrist positions. My chief concern about the rise of opinion is the risk that it leads to an increasingly polarised electorate. In one experiment, Stanford's Jeffrey Cohen asked students to rate a hypothetical social welfare program. The article described the program and then told the student whether Republican or Democratic leaders supported it. It was entirely fictionalised. Cohen found that what mattered were the party leaders' views, not the policy itself. If their party endorsed it, he says, Democrats supported a harsh welfare program, and Republicans supported even a lavish one. As New York University's Jonathan Haidt put it, once group loyalties are engaged, you can't change people's minds by utterly refuting their arguments. And my fear is that the rise of opinion threatens the information commons and risks splitting people into increasingly extreme echo chambers. In one US survey, 77% of respondents said the press tended to favour one side, up from 53% in the mid-1980s. I'm a progressive, but I find the rise of MSNBC as worrying as the rise of Fox News. The second trend that concerns me is nastiness. In her address to the Sydney Institute last year, Annabelle Crabb argued there's a hostile, scratchy feel about politics at the moment. In the latest quarterly essay, Laura Tingle contends that Australia's politics and our public discourse have become noticeably angrier. Now, there have always been people saying ungenerous things about politicians, Very often, these people are politicians themselves. Bob Hawke famously refused to withdraw the claim in Parliament that Malcolm Fraser was a liar. Paul Keating didn't just popularise the term J-curve and banana republic, but also grub and scumbag. In fact, there's an entire website devoted to Keating insults. Mark Latham was so proud of his insults, he used one of them as the title of his book of political quotations, A Conga Line of Suckholes. Barry Cohen's books of anecdotes are replete with examples of parliamentarians calling one another drunks, fools, philanderers. In other countries, the history is worse still. Any discussion about the character of US political debate needs to bear in mind that this is the country where a former Treasury Secretary once shot and killed the sitting Vice President in a duel. But there's two features of the technological shift in the mass media today that have accentuated the nastiness in political reporting: competition from online outlets and anonymity. The impact of competition from online outlets is to reduce the time that outlets have to carry out their fact-checking process. When tabloid papers published on their front page fake nude photos of Pauline Hanson, their haste was partly due to a concern that if they didn't rush to print, they would be scooped by an online site. Competition from online outlets can encourage outlets to exaggerate. One of my favourite tabloid headlines of recent times is this one from July 2011. Workers struggling with a carbon tax are about to be hit with a second wave of Greens-inspired tax pain. Let's go through that headline. Not only was the carbon price a year away, so no one was struggling under it, but the article was about congestion pricing, which federal and state governments had ruled out. But when deadlines are tight, competition is fierce, you can see how people end up cutting corners. Other oft-repeated errors include the claim that Tony Abbott had a reaction to the death of an Australian soldier by saying, "Shit happens." He was in fact summarising another soldier's view. Or the oft-repeated claim that Australia has an economy-wide carbon price, where in fact our carbon price covers about 60% of domestic emissions. The other way that technology can accentuate nastiness is through anonymity. Increasingly, letters to the editor, which must have a name and an address with them, are being replaced by website comments, blogs and tweets. Social media is often anonymous or pseudonymous. In Disconnected, I noted the evidence on how anonymous technologies can turn interactions nasty. In a psychology experiment, students at the University of Texas at Austin were placed in separate booths, assigned a pair, and asked to exchange emails to get to know one another better. In many cases, the conversations quickly became either lewd or rude. As the researchers noted at the end of their article, the male experimenter who conducted the sessions debriefed the participants immediately after the interactions without reading the actual transcripts. He noted that the students were always low-key, unassuming, and moderately interested in the study. No participants appeared embarrassed, shocked, or in the slightest way upset or angry. At the conclusion of the project, when he was given the opportunity to read the transcript, he was astounded, even overwhelmed, to learn what these polite students had been saying to one another over email. If you've ever said something more vitriolic over email or in social media than you would have been willing to say in person, you know how this can happen. Even text messages provide a shield behind which poison darts can be hurled. In the Australian Moment, George Megalogenis describes how 2GB's Alan Jones read out text messages before the Cronulla riots, such as this one. "This Sunday, every Aussie in the Shire get down to North Cronulla to support Leb and Wog Bashing Day." As Megalogenis argues, the common sense filters that we use to keep the letters to the editor page civil and prevent the cranks from getting on air don't apply in cyberspace, because the medium rewards those who generate the most outrage. The problem, as Tony Blair noted in a wide-ranging speech on the media, is that something that is interesting is less powerful than something that makes you angry or shocked. Attacking motive is far more potent than attacking judgment. It is not enough for someone to make an error. It has to be venal, conspiratorial. One academic study found that individuals are more likely to be persuaded by political arguments that play on their fears, even when they're told counter-arguments. Again, this is a matter of information inequality. If genteel discussion is your thing, you now have instant access to Productivity Commission reports and new sites like The Conversation. But for more disengaged news consumers, public debate has become noticeably scratchier. My third concern is that new media technologies are driving towards a shallower national conversation than in the past. One manifestation of this is the rise of showman politicians, and yes, I do mean showman, who are known for their exaggerations and snappy grabs more than for their thoughtfulness. Waiting one morning to speak to reporters on the doors outside Parliament House, it occurred to me the 24/7 media cycle has the same effect on our political system as if we offered a cash prize for the parliamentarian who could come up with the most outrageous line of the day. Another aspect of shallowness is the emphasis on gotcha questions like, will you rule out? Will it increase? Do you promise never to? In one of my first media appearances after being elected, I was asked whether I would stand up for every public sector job in Canberra. I replied it would be silly to do so, given that some public servants are dismissed for cause. A newspaper article the next day omitted the qualifier, simply quoting me as saying, I'm not going to stand up and fight for every public sector job in Canberra. It was a useful lesson as to where straight talk can lead. In the United States, gotcha journalism has now reached such a stage that spokespeople for both the Obama and the Romney presidential campaigns routinely speak to media outlets only on the condition that they have the right to subsequently edit their own quotes. These are spokespeople for the campaign. The thing is that the most interesting policy questions are rarely about whether something will go up or down, but the size of the change. Chances are you're less interested in whether you're getting a pay rise this year than how big that pay rise will be. You don't really want to know whether this speech will ever finish. You want to know when it will finish. Deep reporting focuses on magnitudes. Shallow reporting focuses on whether something's positive or negative. Shallowness can often manifest in picking examples that aren't representative of the broader context. For example, the current inflation rate of 1.2% is the lowest in over a decade. But you can always run a cost of living story by finding items or households for which prices are rising rapidly. Similarly, the current unemployment rate of 5.2% is low compared to recent decades. But a journalist who wants to write about job losses will have little difficulty finding examples. On the average working hour of the average working day, just 1 hour, about 1,530 Australians lose their jobs. And 1,550 find a new job. In discussing school funding, the core question of principle, what's the best way to improve student performance, risks becoming sidelined by trite jabs about hit lists. Another feature of political journalism that's become increasingly ubiquitous is a focus on the horse race element of politics through the lens of opinion polls. As technology has reduced the cost of carrying out opinion polls, their frequency has increased from quarterly to monthly to, in some cases, fortnightly. The trend could easily continue. In the United States, Gallup now conducts daily opinion polls. The typical poll-watching story in Australia tells the reader how the poll has changed since it was last taken, and then discusses how the events of the previous weeks can explain the result. Increasingly, polls are becoming the lens through which many journalists view politics. Problem is, polls are notoriously inaccurate. In an analysis of election eve opinion polls, the last poll taken before polling day, from 1993 to 2010, Murray Goot found that across three major pollsters, News Poll, Morgan and Nielsen, the average prediction error ranged from 1.4 to 2 percentage points, with a median error of 1.8 percentage points. Murray Goot went on to note, if in 1993 an enterprising rogue had set up a pseudo-poll that conducted no interviews but simply worked on the assumption that at every election Labor would get 50% of the two-party preferred vote, he or she would have, wait for it, an average error of just 1.8 percentage points. Unsurprisingly, if you conduct polls earlier than election eve, they have larger errors still. Statistical analysis of volatility in opinion polls also suggests that polls suffer from sampling problems that magnify the true margin of error, maybe even by a factor of two. Journalists who report small movements in opinion polls, 1 or 2 percentage points, without acknowledging the margin of error, may well be misleading their readers. Superficiality isn't something that's emerged in the last decade or so, but it does pose a particular challenge for reforms that are non-intuitive. The arguments in favour of free trade, foreign investment, a floating dollar, a goods and services tax, and a price on carbon pollution are all more subtle than the arguments against them. Lindsay Tannett calls this the sideshow syndrome. He argues it poses a direct threat to the nation's well-being by constraining our ability to discuss major reforms. For politicians, the technological changes in the media have made reflection, doubt, and subtlety more difficult than in the past. A major driver of the shift towards shallowness is the rise of television and the decline of newspapers. Television news bulletins tend to provide less depth than newspaper reports. In 1970, there were more daily newspapers bought each day than there were televisions in the entire country. Now, for every newspaper purchased, there's four televisions. The internet didn't kill newspapers. Their circulation's been declining since the 1980s. But the shift of advertising to the web has dealt a brutal body blow to the economics of newspapers. For the most engaged, the conversation may have become deeper and richer. But for disengaged citizens, the trend has been in the opposite direction. So what should we do about it? From the perspective of regulation, the Finkelstein report, which the government's currently considering, makes the point that when technology changes, legal regimes need to adapt. Take the Sydney Morning Herald website and 9MSN website, two of the most popular news websites in Australia. Right now, content on the Sydney Morning Herald website's largely created by a newspaper, which operates under a voluntary code of conduct regulated by the Australian Press Council. By contrast, content on the 9MSN website's created by a broadcaster with complaints directed to the Australian Communications and Media Authority, a statutory authority. ACMA may consider the suitability of a person who seeks to hold a broadcasting licence. A newspaper proprietor is not subject to such a test. If we're starting from scratch today, it's far more likely we would have created something like Finkelstein's proposed News Media Council than the current regime. But complaints handling bodies are only part of the challenge. in my view, a more significant problem is sustaining the economics of quality journalism. Financial pressures at Fairfax will only accentuate the problems I've spoken about. They'll make it more difficult to sustain innovations such as investigative journalism, a reader's editor, or high-quality pattern journalism that puts a story into its proper context. Google's Hal Varian is right when he urges newspapers to experiment, experiment, experiment. But when newspaper sales have been trending downwards for a generation, it's frankly hard to imagine experiments that will bend the whole curve back upwards again. For university journalism schools, I think the current environment presents a unique opportunity. As well as training the next generation of media professionals, I'd like to see more public interest journalism produced out of university journalism schools. Some of this occurs already. I'd certainly acknowledge Matthew Ricketson's work on the Finkelstein inquiry. But there's considerable scope for it to be expanded. Another proposal, put forward by both Lindsay Tanner and Malcolm Turnbull, is to provide subsidies to quality newspapers. Tanner proposes direct grants. Turnbull suggests providing tax-deductible gift recipient status to newspapers that subscribe to a code of conduct, analogous perhaps to that subscribed to by the ABC. Naturally, such a proposal would need to pass a reasonable cost-benefit test. But I'm inclined to think that the benefit of a better informed public would be likely to justify the cost of the subsidy. In implementing such a proposal, it'd be important to think about how to ensure that public money increased the amount of political information available to those who are disengaged from politics. If you agree with me that the problem is information inequality, there's not much point subsidising content that's directed only towards those who are already engaged. As an economist, I'm naturally drawn towards using price signals rather than regulation to achieve any given aim. It's particularly the case in an area where there's considerable controversy over defining what we mean by quality journalism. I'm not sure you can legislate good journalism any more than you can legislate good taste, but it might be that appropriate subsidies can get us there. And lastly, there's the challenge of how progressive politicians should behave in a changing media environment. The changes I've spoken about pose a particular challenge to progressives. When you look around the world, we're living in an era where social democratic governments are particularly thin on the ground. I'm not sure it's a coincidence that this is happening at a time when the media landscape is fragmenting. The changes afoot are not ideologically neutral. They're particularly beneficial for populists and libertarians. They're particularly confronting for long-game reformers. But for those of us who believe in progressive reform, it's vital we continue to talk about big ideas. In his book, Outliers, The Story of Success, Malcolm Gladwell famously argued you can only get to the top of your profession after 10,000 hours of practice. I think a similar argument applies to reform. Critical reforms like Medicare, universal superannuation, expanding university places, dropping the tariff barriers, didn't happen by themselves. They were the product of passionate and painstaking advocacy. My guess is that politicians who managed to implement major changes are invariably those who've chalked up at least 10,000 hours of advocacy. And I think, too, that progressives need to get better at linking the reforms of today with the events of the past. Too much reliance on talking points and lines can win the battle but lose the war. Humans are fundamentally storytelling creatures, and stories are a powerful way of persuading people about the importance of change, even economic change. Reform isn't about uprooting our history. It's about allowing our values to endure in a changing world. It's about identifying the golden threads that run through our history. George Megalogenis compares the changes today to the insecurity of the stagflation decade. Yet he argues that while the 1970s saw the media emerge as perhaps the only institution to play a constructive role, the media is today an intrinsic part of the problem. Given the transformation that technology was already imposing on the media, the News of the World scandal could hardly have come at a worse time. And yet there's good reasons to be optimistic. We can never return to the old way of doing things. We need to learn to manoeuvre our way in the new environment. The Fourth Estate is going through perhaps the biggest transformation in the past century. For highly engaged citizens, there has never been a better time to be a news consumer. Here's hoping we can eventually say the same for the rest of the population. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Andrew. Andrew's agreed to take some questions from the audience, and we have a roving microphone, I believe. So who would like to begin?
The ABC is a really important part of this. One of the things that I missed the most when I lived for 4 years in the United States was Radio National. NPR in the US is terrific, but because it's funded by subscriptions, it is maddening to listen to. They'll be halfway through some fascinating piece of journalism, talking to factory workers who've just lost their jobs, and you'll have to sit through 10 minutes of words from their sponsor and pleas to send a check in. You come back to Australia, and I love that sense of Radio National that we're going to talk to you about serious ideas. We're not going to be shy about quoting long-dead thinkers. We're not going to be embarrassed about talking about design, philosophy and architecture. So all of that is enormously valuable, and you know, I think the ABC is a part of this. But the ABC has been hit too, and the experiment maxim applies very much to the ABC. We need to recognise the ABC's role in this, but also their need perhaps to adapt faster than some listeners would like. And you can't do new things without ceasing to do some old things. So we need strong support for the ABC. We also need support for the ABC being as nimble and innovative as it needs to be in an incredibly fast-changing media landscape. Great question. Standing in front of their supermarkets is useful. There are many people who have a problem that they would like you to solve, but who either are too nervous to pick up the phone or email, or I think in many cases just too busy. But if they see you standing outside Dixon Woolies or Gungahlin Marketplace, are often willing to come up and chat. The town hall forums are fun in that regard as well. I used to think you did town hall forums to help other people. I now think that the main reason you do them is to make yourself a better politician, just to learn much more about the things that are concerning people, the arguments that resonate, the arguments that don't resonate. And then there's nothing quite like door knocking. The sort of, you know, thinking back to the start of my lecture, that sense of vulnerability of standing on someone's doorstep and asking them how you can help them as well. Now, door knocking's the slowest method of campaigning, but it is also builds the greatest connection with people and does, I think, help to engage the disengaged. But always open to new ideas. I think I spoke about experiment for newspapers. In an environment of change, that's got to apply to my profession as much. Yeah, I mean, you can see some of the stepping around the mainstream media going on in other places. My friend James Booth, who worked on the Obama an Aussie who worked on the Obama campaign, said the right way to think about Barack Obama's election strategy was a massive door-knocking effort with a small TV and speaking sideshow going on. Most of what they were aiming to do, drawing on Obama's work as a community organiser, was to connect directly with people, to go back again and again and have those face-to-face conversations. So that may be an area that we have to go as well. The narrowing down of the budget window, though, is a problem in the sense that this is the most important time to talk about the economic future of the country. And I've even spoken to a Costello advisor who said, you know, they observed this during the period of Costello's treasurership. They just felt it shrinking and shrinking and shrinking, and it was harder and harder to add on those last few events in the final fortnight or week of the budget period. And that then means that the potential for gossip to dominate is much greater. We don't have a deep conversation about one thing for 3 days. We have 9 shallow conversations about tidbits that have popped up here and there. So this is, in part, what you've learned is how an economist thinks about the world. I have taken the economic way of thinking and basically just applied it to the media. And the economic way of thinking essentially has it that you shouldn't regard big changes as being driven by individuals. If your story relies on Malcolm Turnbull, Julia Gillard, Laurie Oakes and Steve Lewis, then it's probably only a small part of the picture. Technology and policy are big, are drivers, are things that can change discontinuously, so we can have snap changes in policy and snap changes in technology. But culture and norms move much more slowly. So if you see a big change in a society, it's unlikely that the change in social mores is driving that, because in general, people's views about the world don't shift rapidly in a way that can drive a tectonic break. So you know, that's I guess my philosophy about what's going on, and that then drives my view that we ought to think back to the technology as being here to stay. In terms of the most disengaged, I mean I don't want to come across as condescending in any way. I think movies and TV are enormously exciting. Families are important to people. Community groups are a great thing to be involved in. And many Australians will continue to see politics as only a very small part of their life. What's important is that for that little window through which people view politics, there is a sense of understanding the big issues rather than getting caught up in gossip and trivia. The window may be small, but we can get better stuff through it. And finally, just as I finish up, I should acknowledge Trudy McIntosh, who's in the back row there, who spent a week in my office as an intern and did extraordinarily helpful work on the speech. Trudy, could you just put your hand up there? So if anyone wants to know anything about social media and these tectonic shifts, Trudy understands it, frankly, far better than I do.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, we're trying to keep these lectures to the hour, and the time is now up. I said in opening this series that we were looking for challenging ideas and not comforting ones, and we heard a thesis that the media is becoming more opinionated, nastier and shallower. I'd say that was a challenging rather than a comforting proposition, so we certainly had the perfect opening lecture for this series. You said that you view the world as an economist, so can I say that I think the benefits of this encounter have greatly exceeded the costs. In fact, arguably it's a pure Pareto outcome where we've all been winners and there have been no losers. So would you please accept these tokens of our gratitude, and please join me in thanking him.